and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a weekly podcast bringing readers and writers of Australian fiction together. I'm Claudine Tennellis. As an avid reader and passionate advocate for Australian fiction, I make it my mission to spotlight local talent. So if you're looking for your next read or simply want to learn more about the Australian literary scene, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and relax. Listeners, the Black and Bright Festival is a literary festival dedicated to the diverse expressions of First Nations storytelling. Established in 2016, this four-day festival is based in Naarm, Melbourne, and covers all genres from oral stories, novels to plays and poetry. With over 60 First Nations artists set to appear at the upcoming festival between the 14th and 17th of March 2024, it is sure to be a fabulous celebration of Black stories. And in honour of this premier cultural event, I am speaking with Julie Jansen. Julie is a Darug woman of the Buru Barongal clan, a playwright, poet and novelist. Julie's 2022 novel, Maduka the River Serpent, an Indigenous crime novel, was longlisted for the Miles Franklin Award. Julie was also a recipient of a couple of poetry prizes that included the Judith Wright Poetry Prize in 2019. Julie's historical novel, Benevolence, was published by McGabala Books in 2020 and published in the US and UK in 2022. Compassion is the follow-up novel to Benevolence and has just been released by McGabala. And it gives me great pleasure to have the chance to speak with Julie about her work on the podcast today. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you very much for having me, Claudine. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Before we started recording, I said I didn't know that you remembered that we met at the Bad Sydney Crime Festival in November of last year. And I was really privileged to listen to you talk on a panel dedicated to discussing the uniqueness of your crime-solving protagonist in Maduka. And then later I snapped a photo of us together at the rooftop bar. So it is truly an honour to see you and speak with you again. And I think that it might be worth talking a little bit about Maduka in the first instance. Can you tell me a little bit about that and how you came to be writing it?
Well, I think maybe I attracted the attention of Jane Harrison, who runs Black and Bright Festival, because of Maduka. I hadn't attracted her attention before, and I've met her once now, which is great. She's a fantastic playwright, and I really admire her work. I admire any playwright who manages to get a play on. It's a darn miracle in Australia. They prefer to put on Chekhov. Anyway, yeah, Maduka came as my kind of relief between writing a historical novel. I thought I'd write another historical novel after Benevolence, but I needed a breather. So I thought I'd write a novel based on a family that I was well attached to, a family I'd made up for a play I wrote, which was called Gungies. Gungies means the police. It was on at Belvoir Street Theatre about 15 years ago, I think. And so I wrote this novel. I called it Wilga. And then working with a good editor, after a while, we found it wasn't really working. And both she and I, at exactly the same time, came up with the idea that I'd turn it into a crime novel. So I'd been working on it for about 2 years. The title got changed, actually, by University of West Australian Press, which is a much better title. It came straight out of the book. And I decided to turn my protagonist, Auntie June, get her to do a TAFE course. A Certificate 3 at TAFE online costs $130. It takes 30 hours and you get a TAFE certificate in investigative services. And I thought, and that's a real thing. And I thought, wow, that's great. She does that online while she's living out, you know, along the Darling River in a dying country town. And she sticks a sign up in the video shop which says, investigation services, confidentiality guaranteed. But all of her clients are Aboriginal women, mostly Nyempa women from the Darling River or Bargingee women, who are trying to get their escaped husbands to pay child support. And nobody can afford to pay her. So they pay her in kangaroo legs and she puts them in the fridge. Anyway, look, I invented Auntie June. I totally enjoyed writing Auntie June. She's a very feisty character in her 50s, based on a lot of the mature Aboriginal women I've had the privilege to know, or you know, aunties I've known, and just people, students I've had through my life as a lecturer. And she grew up in my mind as I made her a single woman so she could have more time and more fun with the men.
Not saying that
married women don't have fun, but I made sure she had a bit more naughty fun. And of course, that kind of a lot of women kind of quite enjoyed reading a woman in her 50s who actually enjoys life, but is actually passionate about saving the Darling River and passionate about solving two murders.
Yeah, incredible. Starting her own private investigation service. And when she gets started and she's investigating the disappearance of her nephew, Tomo, but in the process uncovers water theft and a murder. As you've already alluded to, this book marked a departure from your previous work, writing poetry and plays, and in the case of Benevolence, an historical novel. in setting out to write this novel, how did the finished novel compare to what you set out to write?
Are you talking about Madhuka or my new novel, Compassion?
You know, Madhuka.
Yeah, well, I did set out to write a book about the environment. I'd done some research. I go to the Darling River nearly every year. I used to live in Bourke, in the middle of the Darling. And I'm very much attached to those communities and the very hard kind of history that they've had. A lot of poverty, a lot of racism. The communities have really struggled. And they're thriving communities now, Aboriginal communities, but they really have done it tough, both Barkindji and Nyimpa people and Gamilaroi people as well. So it was really about Aboriginal people standing together to try to save the river from the over-extraction of water, especially from cotton farmers and big business, big agribusiness, taking the water from the river, and which, of course, impacts on everybody, not just Aboriginal people, but, you know, the small farmer who grew oranges or a guy who's got a few sheep. It impacted on everybody. So I got extremely kind of angry when I saw the river completely dry up. And as a result of that, I wanted to write this environmental novel. But I clicked on the way to tell the story when I turned it into a crime novel. And now University West Australian Press has said, oh, we want a series now. And I think, I don't know. I've got it in me. But I am writing a second one for her now, which is called The Bloody Crow. Yeah.
Well, that takes care of one of my next questions, which was, you know, is this a space that you think you'll continue to explore?
Yeah, well, everyone loves Auntie June, and so do I. So, you know, they all want to see what she's going to get up to next. So I'm working on that now.
As I said to you before we started recording, I actually haven't read Benevolence, but as I mentioned earlier, Compassion is the follow-up to that novel and centres on the story of Duringa, the daughter of
Murugging.
Murugging.
Yeah. Okay. Duringa. Well, I don't use her name Duringa very much. I actually just call her Nell, which is easier. Murugging was her mother. But the books stand alone. You don't have to have read one to appreciate the other. But if you have read Benevolence, then there'll be moments when you're reading Compassion, you'll go, oh, that's what happened then. Or, you know, you'll have you don't necessarily have to have read one to appreciate the other. Yeah.
Well, I certainly did appreciate Compassion. That there's so much in this novel that is, quite frankly, difficult to read about Julie, experiences that Nell had as a child and then later as a young woman trying to navigate life in a time that I think it's fair to say was characterized by much violence and lawlessness, especially where the Indigenous community was concerned. So I wanted to ask you, Julie, how and why did you come to be writing about Murugging and Nell, and how difficult was it for you to bring this story to the page?
Well, look, originally, I think if it wasn't for Kate Grenfell's The Secret River, you know, which came out about 15 years ago, when I read that novel and it was about the Aboriginal people depicted were Burrabarungal people, which are my father's people from the Hawkesbury River, from up in the, you know, the Richmond, Windsor area. And I became incredibly angry because I felt that they'd been depicted as people who'd been massacred and no longer existed. And I thought, if that's true, how come there are, you know, at least 6,000 Burrabarungal people living in Blacktown alone? Mm. And what does that mean that my family is? You know, are we all a bunch of, you know, we've imagined our history or whatever? So I did a lot of research to try and write a book that kind of answered those questions. The result was Benevolence. And I based it on what the information I could glean from my own family history. And I mean glean, tiny little fragments of, you know, there's missing birth certificates and maybe a birth certificate might have been or might not have been, and extremely difficult for people of Aboriginal descent to often to trace that family history, because a lot of people didn't marry, just had children. A lot of people never had a birth certificate. And so luckily I'd been employed by University of Sydney on a history project by Professor Peter Reed. I'd helped to research the project, which is called the History of Aboriginal Sydney, which is a huge website. And I found out a lot of information, which kind of generic information, if you like, from Aboriginal elders who gave their information freely being interviewed for this website. And I was able to kind of fill in a lot of gaps about my three times great-grandmother, whose name was Maria Burns, and then her daughter was Mary Thomas. But I decided to change the names because it gave me freedom to write about them in a really creative way. Whereas if you're writing a memoir style, there's always going to be someone who said, oh, she didn't give birth in 1853. It was 1854 and it wasn't in Windsor. It was on Eastern Creek. And I'm just like, no, actually, I needed to allow myself the freedom to create the characters. And I had a revelation when I started writing Compassion, because I decided to write it in first person. And I've never written in first person before. And it just absolutely blew the lid off the story for me. And I've had quite an exciting life, done a lot of volunteering. I've worked in really remote Aboriginal communities. I've done some things that other women go, good God, why did you do that? And I don't know. My dad was a very adventurous man, and I think I just got it from him. You know, you take the challenge and you do something kind of extraordinary, and then you've got lots of really interesting things to write about, you know. So that's what inspired me writing Compassion.
Indeed. Now, talking about the fact that you wrote this in first person, I think what I loved most about this story, Julie, was Nell's voice. And her character really comes through in that first person narrative. She's such a strong-willed woman, someone who isn't easily subdued and indeed rebelled against the oppression that the white settlers represented. But not everyone was as wily or as lucky as Nell, were they?
Yeah. No, 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 about being lucky. I wrote a play many years ago called Black Mary, which is based on the story of Thunderbolt's wife, whose name was Mary Ann Bugg. A very much admired ancestor for Aboriginal people of Warramai or Biripi, a heritage up north of Newcastle towards Taree and inland. And in writing that play, I uncovered the story about her, about how she was on the road with Thunderbolt. But a lot of the planning and the thievery that went on was Mary Ann Bugg. And when I read about my own two times great-grandmother having been up in court in Windsor, three times in the magistrate's court, the first time for stealing 9 fowls, the second time for stealing cattle, and the third time for stealing horses, which was a hanging offence in the 1850s and 1840s. And I thought, good God, she's a lot like Mary Ann Ward, but we don't have, or Mary Ann Bugg, but we don't have much information about her. So I was kind of inspired by the stories that I already had to create this great two times great grandmother. And I thought, well, she kind of, and each time she was in court, she got off. Whereas her male companion, Henry Thomas, was sent away to the lunatic asylum for 5 years, you know. And that put an idea in my head of, her partner's actually suffers from mental illness. And I had a younger brother who suffered from schizophrenia all his life, who I absolutely loved. But it's such a terrible, terrible illness. And I just decided to kind of reinvent him within the character of the paramour of my Nell, to try and celebrate the fact that even people with mental illness can do extraordinary things in the period when they're sane. Yeah. But I loved writing Compassion. I'll mostly write another one, but it won't be Nell. I go up a generation every time I write one of these history books. So it'll be one of her children I'll be writing about. Always women, though. I like to write about the women.
Indeed, indeed. I guess I was thinking that Nell was lucky, and obviously there was a lot in Nell's life that was horrible, and you can't bear to think about the things that Nell went through. But in many ways, I thought that she was lucky because she continued to be able to escape, and she had the gift of the gab, and she had a bit of education, and she was able to talk her way out of a lot of situations, and she was just she was smart. She was so smart that I just thought, my gosh, you know, other women in those same situations may not have got themselves out.
Sure. My Aboriginal heritage comes down through the women until my dad, you know. I can trace back 3 generations. And they were all survivors. And often the way they survived was by marrying white men, by marrying ex-convicts, or that often gave children protection. If you were married to an Aboriginal man, much more likely under the Aboriginal Protection Board, what a misnomer that is, from about the 1880s, your children would be removed. If there were 2 Aboriginal parents, had high chance they would be removed. And you'd always be on the run to stop your children being taken away. So the fact that in my family that they'd had European husbands, I think helped to protect children. And in fact, on my side of the family, my father used to say, oh, our family was very wealthy and they owned half of Wilberforce out near Windsor. And I'd be going, what? You know, when I actually looked into it, sure enough, way back, you know, a convict on the Second Fleet was part of our heritage. And he did have land grants out there, but it was well and truly lost by the time of my father's generation, I can tell you. But that interesting convergence of English history, or English and Irish history particularly, with Aboriginal history is something I'm really interested in, because a lot of Aboriginal people in New South Wales have got that combined history. And I just think it's something worth looking into. It's not always violence against women. It's not always rape and mistreatment, but there are a lot of loving marriages as well. And I've always thought that was an interesting area that people didn't often explore. And also what happened to Aboriginal men, that they had it really tough. They were killed in many more numbers on the whole than Aboriginal women.
Yeah. Just going back to Nell a little bit, I think her strength and her downfall also was her compassion.
Yeah.
If Her compassion towards other people. I mean, she gave away money to people less fortunate than her. And even if that meant that she would have to go without or steal later to feed herself, and her inability to see people abused without trying to defend them if she could. And I think that given everything Nell had been through in her short life, it made this part of her character all the more incredible, because in many ways it would have been, her life would have been easier if she showed less regard for the welfare of others, right?
Yeah. Well, she's based on, people like my mum and me and my daughter Zoe too. We seem to have this kind, and my mum's English, by the way. She's not Aboriginal. My dad's Aboriginal. But Dad used to give away everything. He'd bring back baskets of fish from a fishing trip, and we'd end up with about two fish because he gave all the rest to the neighbours. He'd just give away everything. Dad never had any money because he shouted every man in the pub, He was terrible. And now I know where I get it, I've never got any money. I'm always giving it away to the grandchildren or something. But like if I'm in a city like Melbourne now, I find it incredibly hard to walk down the street because there's so many homeless people.
Yeah.
And it kind of breaks my heart. And I can't, it's to the point where I don't want to be in big cities because I just, it's so painful. I can't, it's like I end up not being able to see anything else other than the homeless. So it's a kind of a genetic thing, I think. And my mum's a bit like that too, is that if you see people who are suffering, it's very hard to go into a posh restaurant and order an expensive meal and I'll have a really glass of the most expensive wine you've got. I couldn't give a damn about all of that. I'd much rather share the, if you've got anything, share it out. And I wrote her like what my family is like, that they have that inbuilt kind of sense of, and my father always said, stick up for the underdog. If you're the only person in the room who thinks that someone is being mistreated or that something is wrong, you stand up and speak your truth. And I've lived my life by that adage. Yeah.
Indeed, indeed. You spoke, Julie, earlier about your adventurous spirit, and I think this is something you've imbued Nell with as well. She has an incredibly adventurous spirit, and at first it's about finding her long-lost mother, but later it became more than that. So I wondered if you could talk to me a little bit about Nell's journey and why this was something you wanted to explore in the novel.
I worked with a very good editor called Jane Messer, who's also a wonderful writer. And Jane, towards the end of, I've been working on the novel for about 2 years, and she said, Julie, look, this novel is like a great big overstuffed couch. It's full of wonderful ideas and stories and adventures and characters and amazing scenes and colourful images and Aboriginal language. She said, but it misses the three buttons that pull the couch together to make it structured. And it was such a good kind of metaphor. And I kind of went, okay, and what are the three buttons? She said, the three buttons are Nell's mother, her child, and her father. She said, if you bring those three characters up and strengthen them in the novel will hold together. And it was just such a simple structural observation. And I totally got what she was talking about. And I went back and I also brought up the mother-in-law, the Susan Smythe, who I absolutely enjoyed writing so much. She became, the death crone, if you're looking at archetypes. And I do love writing somewhat flawed and awful people. I get that from my love of writers like Charles Dickens or Dostoevsky. If you read broadly the greats, they do, and read them often, they do filter through into your brain and you learn wonderful lessons. But because of Jane, I managed to pull the structure of that novel together. So I thank her most thoroughly at the back of the book, because without her simply giving me that instruction, I don't know that I would have seen it. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, there's much talk in the novel about the colour of Nell's skin and comparisons between her and other Aboriginal women. And clearly she was of mixed heritage, but most clearly identified as an Aboriginal woman. Can you talk to me about that and why this was important for you to address?
It's a really hard question for people who are fair like me. You can have a really dark dad, or like we did, and yet you'd be, people would say, oh, you're right, you can pass. You don't have to tell people you're Aboriginal. And it's just like, no, that doesn't feel right. That's not what I want, And so you get very attuned to racism based on colour. And you've got to be very aware of it yourself. I mean, when I go to the Northern Territory, which I do a lot because my daughter lives in Darwin, she's a social worker in Darwin, and I lived in remote communities up there in Arnhem Land, and people are definitely a much, much darker hue than me. And they'd look at me and think, oh, they call me a Wajala or a yellow fella. In other words, you're not, you might have a bit of Aboriginal blood, but you're not like us. Mm. And that's just a fact of life. But I think in cities now and in contemporary Australia, there's an acceptance of people if they're accepted by their community and identify and have family connections, then they can, you know, they're Aboriginal. But it's a tricky question. And I get her to deal with it in her own way too. People sort of say, oh, well, you know, with a bit of makeup, you could pass. It's insulting, but that's the kind of language you have to listen to.
Julie, if there was one thing that you would like readers to take away from compassion, what would it be?
I would like them to reconsider the truth-telling of Australia. We may have lost that referendum, but the chance to do truth-telling, which is happening now in Adelaide and in Victoria as well, good state governments bringing forward discussions of treaty and the truth-telling process. I think it's really important. If anyone's read that fantastic book by David Marr called Killing for Country, which you have to read in sections because it is so horrific that you can't sleep at night. You have to keep putting it down. But what it shows you is that the massacre of Aboriginal people throughout Australia was systematic and government paid for. Systematic, organised, controlled and paid for by the Australian government of the day. And when you read that, instead of going, oh, well, there was a massacre here or there was a reprisal here or there was a battle here over cattle or there was... No, it was a systematic massacre of every single Aboriginal person they could get their hands on in remote communities, and not just remote communities, all over Queensland and northern New South Wales from the 1880s onwards. And there'd already been massacres in the 1840s, 50s, 60s. And I just think we have to face that truth. It's really horrible and it gives you nightmares. But if Australia doesn't face that truth, how can we move on and have a genuine equality with Aboriginal people to actually understand that their rights actually are special and are different? They're not the same as the latest immigrant because of what they've suffered, what we've suffered. Yeah. So I get quite passionate about that.
Of course. And it goes back to a little bit about what I was saying earlier, because parts of your novel were quite difficult to read.
Even though
Nell goes on a rather swift journey, you cover a lot of ground in a lot of these chapters.
A lot's happening.
A lot is happening. But you do get a very clear sense of what you just said, this systematic eradication and massacre of the Aboriginal people, and that ideology of the white person that, oh, your race will soon be extinct. Yeah. And I feel like you dealt with it in a way that you didn't dwell on it as such, but you can feel that it is still there.
Well, my novels are always character driven in a really big way, you know. I love dialogue, and I think with dialogue, because my background is a playwright, I was 15 years as a playwright. I love to hear the voices of characters and for their voices to portray their inner thought. I often think when I read and written by a good journalist, they haven't learned to listen to the voices, and the voices revealing the subtext, the inner motivation, the psychology of the character. And that's the challenge, to make characters that are really full on the page. And that gives me tremendous pleasure. So when an editor might say, oh, we need to cut out some of this dialogue, I say, you can cut anything you want, but don't touch the dialogue. I'm getting tougher at standing up for my rights.
Oh, I love that, Julie. So let's talk about Black and Bright and the festival. I wanted to ask you, Julie, what does this festival mean to you?
Well, it's a real honour to be included. I mean, I found, like, I'm, you know, at one stage I'm on the stage with Kim Scott, who's a fantastic writer from West Australia. I love, you know, When Dead Men Dance and some of his earlier novels. And he's someone that we look up to, you know, in the writing world. And Tony Birch is fantastic. Alexis Wright, Leah Purcell, there's so many wonderful writers in that lineup. You know, it takes a long while to get published. Well, I found it did. Other people maybe not so. And to be included with such writers of esteem is great for me. I have to pinch myself sometimes that I've been included. I'm very pleased. But the best thing about being a novelist is that you do get invited to writers' festivals, if you've got a new book out especially, which is why it's worthwhile every 2 years trying to get one out before I, you know, drop dead. And you meet such fabulous, I've become quite good friends with Nadi Simpson, and she wrote The Song of the Crocodile, and she's a fantastic poet. Oh, but the worst thing is if you get invited to be on a poetry thing with her and you're reading your poems and she comes up and sings hers and she's so fantastic. You might as well just pack up your book and, you know, slink out the back and go and hide behind a tree or something. I mean, she's so fantastic and a beautiful voice, accompanies herself with a guitar or something, show off. And, you know, yeah. So, yeah, it's wonderful. And there's some Torres Strait Islander writers coming up now, like Lenora Thaka. Her book will be out with text by the end of the year. And, you know, you meet such sensational Indigenous writers.
I love that. Mm. And you're appearing at two sessions at this festival. I think one of them is a craft session. Is that correct?
Not really sure. We're just talking about how we write novels, I think. So that'll be easy, I hope. I don't know. The other one's much more of a challenge, which is the work and life, 12 images from your life. And I was asked, I think there's six of us or something, maybe there's even more, maybe there's eight of us doing it, sitting on the stage at ACME. And I thought, oh, okay, right. Please give us a straight back chair and not a lounge chair, because I always look like a sack of potatoes in a lounge chair. And 12 images from your life. And I'm thinking, what a picture of me with my dog, or, you know, I mean, my office, which I better tidy it up if I'm going to photograph that. I felt a bit confused at first. And then I thought, oh, look, just whatever, send some photos, you know. And so I did. And I've looked at other people's photos, like Daniel Browning, have much better photos than mine. In the end, I'll just go with the flow and just, yep, here I am, me with my dog. You know. Someone once asked me what was the difference between being a play and being a novelist. And I said, well, when you're a playwright, you're standing around at, you know, Belvoir Street Theatre with sexy actors and fabulous directors and designers. And when you're a novelist, you're in a darkened room for 2 years in your slippers, feeling really depressed. And that's the difference. So when they invite you out, all the novelists are terribly excited to be out, you know, out of the darkened room, you know, out of their slippers, got to put real shoes on, you know, and meeting each other and meeting readers. I love to meet readers, you know. It's so nice. People come up and say, look, I really love this, or I really like that, or... Well, they tell you that, you know, you wrote something wrong in the book, which is which is fine. Take it on board.
Oh, I love that, Julie. So what's next for you? Are you working on something else at the moment, or just taking a bit of a breather?
Well, no, I don't really take breathers anymore, because it took me a long, long time to get published. And now that I'm on a bit of a roll, and I mean, I meet friends who are wonderful writers who haven't been able to, who are self-published writers, which I did do myself early in the early days. And I just feel their pain, because often they're brilliant. But, you know, if you're not hitting the right note at the right time, it's very hard to get published. So I'm writing another crime novel for Auntie June called The Bloody Crow. And it's set in the Northern Territory, where I go a lot, because my daughter lives up there and my grandson, and she was born in Katherine, my daughter. So I'm setting a new novel around the Katherine area, and it's about the fracking of Aboriginal communities, the fracking of the river systems. And it's another environmental novel, and I feel passionate about that, because I saw a map up there and there were red circles around every single Aboriginal community, and they'd been marked for fracking. Mm. And I'm just like, what? Yeah, so they're not marking the huge... Yeah, international consortium of cattle owners land, they're marking the Aboriginal communities because they think they're an easy thing to attack.
Yeah.
And all these communities have been due to massacres and racism and land stolen. And now we're going to frack their water, you know. Mm-hmm. And so if I get enraged, I write a novel. Well, not quite, but I think you have to have a passion for the subject you're going to write about. You know, you have to feel deeply about it, otherwise I think you get bored halfway through and you wouldn't finish. And I don't believe in not finishing something. I always finish what I begin. And that's another hint for beginner writers too. If you start a short story, heavens above, finish it. You know, don't leave it sitting on the computer and go back to it 5 years later, because you won't care. Just push through, even though it's painful. Yeah, I'll write another environmental novel. And but I part of me kind of thinks, like, it takes maybe 2 years to write the novel, or maybe a year to get it published out. In 3 years' time, those communities I really care about in the Northern Territory will already be fracked. They'll already be destroyed. And so, yeah, it's painful. I join the, you know, protest movement when I'm up there too, up in Darwin. I go and sit on some of the protests, but, you know, I'm just one voice. Yeah.
Julie, just going back to what you said earlier, you had a tip for aspiring authors out there. I wondered if you had a couple more that you might offer.
Okay, all right. Turn on your computer and write every day, or your notebook if that's your preferred way. I turn the computer on every morning at about 8 and then I sit down, even though I don't want to.
Yeah.
I force myself to. Some people find that setting themselves a timer is good, and they just do, I have to write nonstop for 5 or 10 minutes. I don't need to set a timer because once I begin, usually I'm okay. And I find 4 hours later, I look up and think, oh dear, I better get out of the seat. Otherwise I'm going to, you know, grow into it or something. I often end up writing a lot longer than that. But it's like when you're on a roll, you're on a roll. But when you're not, you're not. Once I'm writing a novel, I'm like, I'll read a fantastic journalist article in the Guardian or on the Saturday paper, and it'll inspire me to look into something. I know I hear people on a bus talking and I think, oh, I'll just write down everything they said. Or you use your relations who are particularly appalling, you know, and pick out some of the things that they say that are absolute clangers. And you think, oh, I'm putting that in the next book. They don't read them anyway. They won't know. And I just think you have to be alert. Well, you're an artist. You're the same as a painter or a theatre maker. You have to think like an artist and be alert to pick up information whenever you see it, and do your research. But don't spend 5 years in the library to write the book, because, you know, you're just going to be an academic if you do that. Yeah, I use my phone a lot, my iPhone. I'll use notes. And if I'm waiting for something, you know, and I've got to sit there in a doctor's surgery or something, I will write a whole lot of notes, and I just email them to myself, which is a great function, really, because the moment you get it on your email, you can cut and paste it and stick it straight into the novel with a bit of adjustment. So I use that a great deal, and I do recommend that people start using the notes on their iPhones. Stop scrolling and looking at garbage and write something original.
Julie, if listeners wanted to connect with you or learn more about you and your work, where can they find you?
Well, I've got a website, which is www.juliejansonwriter.com. And there is a function there to send me a message, which I do answer. I answer every message, you know, however obscure it is. You know, I get invited to some very obscure things. And if people pursue me over a time, like I remember the Liverpool Library really wanted me to come out and talk about benevolence. And, you know, libraries often, well, they can't pay you very much, and, you know, and they certainly don't pay for your travel, and you're lucky if you get lunch, you know. And it was a long way for me to drive. And the first year I said, no, no, no. And the librarian just kept writing and saying, we would really like to talk. Yeah. And finally I said, oh, all right. And I turned up. There's only about 10 people in the audience, but we had a lovely time. And it was the librarians are fabulous people. They were so grateful and so happy. And I said, well, I'm going to put there was a historical building right next to the library, part of the Historical Society for Liverpool. I said, it's going in the next novel. So it appears in Compassion. And they were thrilled. They're like, oh, we're in the novel.
What a great story. Julie, I wanted to say it's been such an honour to chat with you this morning about your work and the upcoming Black and Bright Festival. I wish you every success with it, and thank you very much for joining me on Talking Aussie Books.
It's going to be an audio book. It's being recorded right now on
Fantastic.
Audio.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah, I love it.
And the same wonderful reader, Tamala, who recorded Benevolence. So you could get both in a row. And she rings me up and I have to give her the pronunciation of all of the Darug words, which really, I'm no linguist, I can tell you, but I have had the privilege of working in very remote communities and learning quite a little bit of Yolngu Mata, Yolngu language. The knowledge of another Aboriginal language often gives you a little bit of insight on how to pronounce it. But I think if my ancestors came alive, they'd be just kind of rolling on the floor with laughter of, you know, of my pronunciation. But at least it's better than other people's. And I gave her 40 minutes of pronunciation. I had no idea I had 120 Darug words in it. You know, what was I on? Why did I do that? But it's part of my principle to bring back languages that are that are fading. And if we don't use the Darug language, no one will know anything about it, because it's not a living language. So we bring it back through text.
That was one of the many, many things that I really enjoyed about this book, Julie. Thank you again for your insights and for making the time to chat with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. You're soft and amusing, Claudine. I quite enjoy that.
That's one of the nicest things anyone's ever said to me. That's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, please drop me a line via my webpage at claudinetonellis.com, via Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Alternatively, consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Until next time, happy reading.